Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We're beginning the show today by talking with you about traffic safety. We got a good expert for you, Randy Wiesinger, a 29-year veteran of the Dane County Sheriff's Office before his retirement. He's currently a consultant for the Wisconsin Department of Transportation's Bureau of Transportation Safety. And as we talk with him today, I hope you'll join in. What questions do you have about how to stay safe on the roads? What have you observed? Give us a call. The number, 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Randy Wiesinger, welcome. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Good morning, Larry. Good to be here.
You retired in 2015. You had 29 years with the Dane County Sheriff's Department. How much has traffic safety been the focus of your career?
Well, prior to my retirement, over half my career was with the Traffic Enforcement Unit in Dane County, a motorcycle enforcement unit. So it's been a focus of my career throughout, but the last half I was dedicated strictly to traffic enforcement, and I've been doing traffic safety consulting since then.
I want to go into more detail a little bit later on about driver's education, but from your perspective, how important is driver's education for teenagers?
Well, it's absolutely critical. And as a parent that had three kids come up through the teen years and learn to drive, I was very passionate about it then. I personally investigated numerous traffic fatal crashes that involved teen drivers, and those are always hard to deal with. And so that all has been a passion of mine throughout.
Yeah, I think we had something like 580 traffic deaths or fatalities in the state in 2023, and I think between 2019 and 2023, there were a couple hundred of them were teenagers, young drivers.
Yeah, our teens, throughout the state, and we're not necessarily unique in that way, unfortunately, across the country. Teens are overrepresented in crashes, so they can represent in any given community or county, anywhere from 12 to 20% of the crashes, but they're usually only about 5% of our drivers.
Yeah.
So they're not always at fault. I'm quick to point that out. The teen isn't always at fault, but due to their lack of experience behind the wheel, they may not avoid a crash that you or I might avoid.
Yeah, yeah. I'm thinking about cell phones a bit. I don't know how many times I've had a stop sign and the light changes and the car in front of me is not going anywhere, and you can see that the person is looking at their cell phone.
Yeah, and I'm not, I don't think it would be proper to say that that's just teens.
No.
Actually, our teens and younger people have had cell phones in their hand their entire life, where older people, it's still new technology, and so I think sometimes middle age and older people are more distracted by cell phones than younger people are, but it's definitely a problem, without a doubt.
Yeah, it's distracted driving, I think is what it's called.
That is correct.
And there were, and this kind of a law, I mean, it's, you're not supposed to be looking at your phone, but enforcing that must be difficult.
Well, yeah, it is. In Wisconsin, we have a state statute that prohibits texting while driving. It's been around for a number of years now, but for decades and decades, we've had a state statute that addresses inattentive driving, and they're really kind of the same. Whether you're paying, whether you're distracted by the radio on your dash, the phone in your hand, or the McDonald's meal in your lap, distracted driving is a problem. It's not always the phone.
Yeah. And yesterday, I think it was yesterday, it was buckle up, phone down day, wasn't it?
Yes, yes.
That was a campaign by the DOT, and it was just to urge drivers to put their phones down and quit eating that McDonald's burger
Yep, it's a unique campaign. I mean, we're always trying to get more people to wear seatbelts. Thankfully, in Wisconsin, our seatbelt usage rate as of last year has climbed up to 92%. People are buckled up, which is great because it's a life-saving action that everybody can take. But then the distracted driving is definitely a focal point of traffic safety.
Yeah. Cater and Herbster has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Cater.
Hey, in the last 10 years, all over the country or different places in the country, I've seen this huge increase in street racing, not only on the interstate, but in cities. And I wonder if you could tell me about the law enforcement issues with that, how they are communicating with each other, and what you should do if a pack of cars going 150 miles an hour on the interstate is suddenly all around you.
What do you think, Randy?
You know, it's one of those things that it is a problem in certain communities, certain jurisdictions. It's not widespread, thankfully, around here. It's a big challenge for law enforcement because of technology, right? These people have lookouts, if you will, so they're gonna disperse if law enforcement shows up, and so but law enforcement does the very best that they can to try to track them down. If you witness it, by all means, it's a 911 call, and I would either pull over and stop or disengage yourself from being around those reckless drivers.
Yeah. George in Janesville, we'll go to you. George, what's on your mind?
Well, I've got a couple things, but the first thing is the problem with elderly and handicapped drivers and the challenges of very low street lighting now and bright headlights. And the police aren't doing anything about people who don't dim their headlights. In fact, probably at least 10 to 20% of the public is driving around with bright headlights on. That's one thing that bothers me.
I think part of that is a mechanical thing with the kinds of the new lights, Randy.
Yeah, I'm not sure that the frequency of people having their high beams on is that high versus the perception that they have their high beams on because of newer, brighter LED technology, which I will agree is kind of a balancing thing. I have a newer vehicle that has pretty bright lights, and it's really nice to be able to see at night and both the side of the road and further out. But at the same time, those lights are pretty bright when they're coming at you. An age-old technique that we teach people, including teenagers, whether they're on their high beams or not, or just these newer headlights, is not look at the lights. It's counterintuitive. Human instinct is your eyes are going to track towards the oncoming lights, but you really need to focus on the white line to your right until those lights go by, so you're not blinded by those lights.
Oh, that's a good tip. Just keep your eyes on the white line on the right so you're not going to drive off the road, but then you're not blinded by those lights that are coming at you in the middle of the night on Interstate 90.
Yeah, and again, and technology is great, right? We have better cars, safer cars. A lot of the newer cars have auto sensing bright lights. That's what my vehicle has. We're an oncoming vehicle. It'll automatically dim those lights, but I think that they still are perceived to being on high beams, but they're not.
Dennis in Oshkosh will give you a chance to join in. Hi, Dennis.
Hi, good morning. I have a kind of a comment question. I don't know if people realize that. I don't think most people do, that when we have these vehicles today whose headlights are on all the time or come on automatically when conditions warrant it. The problem, and it makes no sense to me, that 95% of these vehicles, at least 95, only have headlights on.
As opposed to?
Taillights, unless you override it.
Oh, okay. Randy, comment on that?
Yeah, I can't really comment or validate the percentage, but I do know that when daytime running lights, that's what he's referring to, daytime running lights became, you know, kind of the commonplace, and that they've been around for quite a while, that you're just your daytime running lights, and they're not even full headlights, would be on all the time. It presented a couple of challenges for drivers of newer vehicles. One, they thought that their daytime running lights are on all the time, so they didn't have to turn on their lights in times of poor visibility, like fog, like we had this morning, and we frequently have, and it doesn't turn on your actual headlights, and or it doesn't turn on your taillights. So that's a driver education issue, you know, and I really think it starts with the dealers, and the people that buy these vehicles need to know how to operate these vehicles and when their lights are on or when they're not.
Yeah, I tell you what, the vehicles are a lot different in terms of what they can do or can't do for you than when you and I started driving.
That is very true.
Very true indeed. You can join in too today as we talk. We're focusing on driver's education, but of course dealing with all matters relating to being on the road with our guest today, Randy Wiesinger, retired Dane County Sheriff's Detective, currently law enforcement liaison and consultant for the Wisconsin DOT Bureau of Transportation Safety. And he's the owner of Wiesinger Consulting, LLC, based in DeForest. Questions or comments for him, you can join in. The number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Taking a look at driver safety and driver's education today with Randy Wiesinger, who is a law enforcement liaison and consultant for the Wisconsin DOT and is owner of Wiesinger Consulting based in DeForest. Great to have him along. Questions or comments? I hope you'll join in. 800-642-1234. Email to talk@wpr.org. Mark in Boulder Junction has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Mark.
How are you doing today, Larry? And hope your guest is surviving his driver's ed courses. being a rules guy, and I was a basketball ref for many years, what WIAA did is they showed videos that you were required to watch just for new rules. And to me, I think the DOT misses a chance when people go in there to require them to just sit and some of the most common errors we make in driving, just a video to watch, nothing to try to get people out of driving, just to remind people. And we all make mistakes, but there's so many things I think older drivers have forgotten and just gotten in bad habits. And then just a second question. Do they actually do a on-road test for older drivers, you know, 70 and older? Probably wouldn't be a bad idea.
All right, Randy, comments. A couple of things there.
I like that idea. I do believe there's other states that have continuing education. I know there are. Wisconsin does not really per se, certainly doesn't mandate anything. Once you have your license and keep renewing it, you're kind of on your own. But I think that's it's a great opportunity. I'm not in charge of the Department of Motor Vehicle and license renewal or that type of stuff. So, you know, again, I think there's a lot of opportunity there. I will say that it can be a personal choice. There are resources available. We don't re-road test older drivers unless they're referred by law enforcement through a report called a driver condition report. Law enforcement might encounter somebody that is involved in a crash and doesn't think that their driving skills are where they're supposed to be. They can fill out a driver condition report, and that will mandate they go into DMV and be retested. But short of that, there's a lot of resources out there, and especially organizations like AARP, for example, has an older driver education course that you can offer in your community. But right now, that's a proactive thing. You'd have to take the initiative yourself in your community to do that. ADRC is in a lot of communities. They have education opportunities as well. Because I will tell you that older drivers, I made a comment earlier about teen drivers, are overrepresented in crashes based on the number of people holding a license as a teen. The same can be said. We use 65 and older. It's just an arbitrary number, but the older you get, the more your skills diminish in driving, and the faster things are happening out there. But the more important factor there is that the older we get, the less survivability we have of a crash. So my example is a 30-year-old can be involved in a crash, and a 65 or 70-year-old can be involved in the exact same crash, and they're going to have much more severe injuries. So there's an opportunity there to educate our older drivers.
Daryl in Wausau, we'll give you a chance to join in. Hi, Daryl.
Oh, hi. Thank you for taking my call. Say, I do a lot of driving and a lot often at night or after dark. And one thing I really noticed in the last, 15 years or more, that people don't realize they don't have any lights on their vehicle when it gets dark. And I think some of that is because in the older vehicles, if you did not have at least your marker lights on, your dash would still. Now these newer.
You're breaking up, unfortunately, Daryl. But Randy, I think you got the gist there.
Yeah, and it kind of relates to one of the earlier callers. That's the technology that a lot of vehicles have, where the daytime running lights come on. And in some vehicles, that includes your dash lights. And so unless you are aware and knowledgeable with your particular vehicle, you may misunderstand that your taillights aren't on. In urban areas, we have better lights. Street lights a lot of times are LEDs now. And so we see cars driving down the road that don't have any lights on whatsoever. They just don't perceive that. But that's a driver behavior, driver education issue. People need to know exactly how their car works.
Daryl, thank you again. Courtney in Madison, your turn. Hi, Courtney.
Good morning. I'm so excited to be here. Thank you for having the platform and this education. I appreciate both of you. My question today is how to be a good defensive driver when driving around roundabouts. Often there are some vehicles that, don't quite know how to get through the roundabout safely, and they might turn off early and they're in the wrong lane. So what would be some good tips to be a defensive driver in roundabouts?
Well, first and foremost is speed. Reduce your speed. Roundabouts have saved countless lives and injuries because they don't always reduce the number of crashes, but they reduce the severity of those crashes, from angled crashes to glancing blows or fender benders. But we do have in Wisconsin, and like a lot of other areas, we have a variety of different roundabout designs. But the one thing that they all rely on is you yield traffic to your left. Smaller the roundabout, sometimes you really don't know if that person's exiting right before they get to you or they're coming all the way around. So you just have to slow down and yield to them. And unfortunately, I think roundabouts, because they allow you to keep going without stopping at a stop sign or stoplight, people feel like they should just take the roundabout as fast as they're comfortable. Well, you need to slow down and look to the left and always anticipate that car coming around the roundabout is going to come all the way around the roundabout until you see otherwise.
Courtney, thank you for calling. Appreciate your call. I was thinking back to my a long time ago, back in the 80s, I spent a year at the University of the West Indies in Trinidad, and I had never come in contact with a roundabout. And there, everybody had been doing it for a long, long time. Boy, was that a quick learning experience I had to take. They were usually not slowing down much when they got to those roundabouts. So the slowing down is really, and watching those cars on your left is, as you say, Randy, is really good advice. Richard in Beloit, your turn. Hi, Richard.
Yes, comment on those roundabouts. Maybe they should put those rumble strips in front of them to slow them up, because they're always hitting it at 30 miles an hour.
Yeah.
But anyway, maybe some of these people every 10 years should have a education course, redriving test, so that they understand they're missing out on using their signals and using their proper techniques of driving. And the other thing would be with semis, we always have to have a safe distance in front of us, and that distance is always filled up on by cars trying to get ahead of the next car.
Yeah. Richard, thanks. Richard speaking from experience here, but Randy, comment.
Yeah, I can relate to Richard's experience because before I got into law enforcement, I drove semi-cross country for a couple of years, and it wasn't no different back in the early 80s than it is now. All you can do is control the vehicle that you are driving, but we've had a couple of people refer to that ongoing or continuing education for drivers, and again, I think that's a great idea. It's a great opportunity. I don't think that Wisconsin's going to be mandating that anytime soon, but it does not mean that individuals can't take it upon themselves and communities can't take it upon themselves to take that road.
You know, we should talk a bit more about driver's ed. Fewer teenagers are receiving driver's instruction through their schools. I mean, when I was in high school, we had to, you know, you get to that 16 or 15 years old, you could had to take the driver's test or the course. And I hope it's, no, I'm sure that it's changed a lot over the years. I remember having to watch a very gruesome traffic accident, a real one. And people were, the other, you know, some students were gasping and getting sick watching it. I don't know if those had any impact at all. Randy, that education program has changed considerably, I'm sure.
It certainly has. And actually in Wisconsin, there's very, very few high schools now that have their own driver's ed program. Most of it is privatized through private driver training schools or organizations like CESA that provide it outside of the school day. I'm going to refrain on commenting on that, whether that's good, bad, or indifferent. It's just times change. But driver's ed curriculum, ever since you started driving, Larry, and I started driving, relied very heavily on parent involvement. So you have behind the wheel, you take a course, you still do that. You can do some things online that we certainly couldn't back then. But it relies on parents behind the wheel. 50 hours of observation, I think, is the current standard here in Wisconsin. But I'll tell you, as long as you took me down this road, because I'm kind of passionate about teen driving, teens start to learn to drive long before we think they do. We now in Wisconsin allow them to get their temps, as we call them, at 15. It used to be 15 and a half. Now they're at 15. But they actually start to learn to drive. And there's some national research on this that we just picked up on and we're starting to work on here in Wisconsin. In fact, the kids start to learn to drive when their car seat turns around and starts facing forward. There's a very powerful video called Strings on YouTube that shows how kids learn what they see. And we should all know that from having toddlers and young elementary school kids, middle school kids, they're learning based on what they see their parents do. And if that is bad behavior, we can't expect driver's ed to fix that 6 weeks after they've been watching it for 10 years. So we have a lot of opportunity to improve our parent, what we call parent modeling, that'll have an impact on teen driving down the road.
That's really good. That's a very good point. I hadn't even thought about that, but you're just made me realize as you were talking about it. Yeah. I mean, the kids, they're paying attention to what their parents are doing. So if you're running a light like the guy who was in front of me this morning on the way to work, the yellow light was, you could see that it was going to turn to red. And he apparently assumed the red light was just a suggestion and went right straight through a red light. And you can imagine as dangerous as it was, but you could also imagine if he'd had a young child in the car with him. That's behavior modeling the wrong way.
most parents have used the used the old adage of "do as I say, not as I do." But when it comes to traffic safety and learning to drive, I think it's a really important observation for our younger parents. You know, that they're modeling right from the time that the child turns 4 or 5, and so you can't let them see something for 10 years and then tell them, "Well, don't do it the way I did it," and expect good results, right?
Exactly. Karen and Madison, we'll give you a chance to join in. Hi, Karen. Karen, are you there? Oh, I think we lost Karen. So let's go to Tom and Madison. Tom, hello.
Hello there. This has sort of become a pet peeve call-in show, but I have more of a question related to one of my pet peeves, and it has to do with a stoplight intersection, and you're taking a left turn. How far into that intersection should you move to wait for oncoming traffic to take that left turn?
Well, I think the technical definition is you should not enter the intersection until you can make that left turn. But practically, I would not go, you know, where we see problems is you enter into the intersection and then you're halfway through the intersection, your wheels are turned left, the lights change, and there you are stuck. And that you can't be in the intersection once the light turns red. If you're in the intersection when the light turns red, you're violating that red light. So the technical answer there is you don't enter the intersection until you're able to turn left.
Very good. Very good education there. Let's go to Jonah in Ellington. Jonah, hello.
Hi there. Thanks for having me on. So it's my understanding that it takes 4 DUIs in the state of Wisconsin in order to be considered a felony. Why is it so high? And would you recommend, in your personal view, do you think it would be better for the safety of Wisconsinites on the road if we made it 3 or even 2 would be considered a felony?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's a good discussion point that it's outside my purview to really weigh in on you know, what our current laws are in Wisconsin, but I can tell you that you can do your own research and check the what it's like in other countries, for example, and even some of the other states, and what that does for repeat offenders. We have an issue with, and this is not just impaired driving, drunk driving, but overall, what I call the cultural acceptability of traffic crashes, whether they're from speeding drivers, red light runners, drunk drivers, distracted drivers. Traffic safety and traffic crashes is really a public health issue. It's a community issue. It's not just a law enforcement issue. It's not a DOT issue. It affects each and every one of us. In Wisconsin, we kill somewhere between 575 and 600 drivers or people on our roadways every year. Every year. In the country, we killed over 41,000 of them last year on our roads. When you look at some of our counterparts in Sweden and Netherlands, there's no cultural acceptability for impaired driving there. You do it once, you go to prison. So that's something, it's a great discussion point, but it's something that people need to be involved in at the community level.
Thanks again for that comment. Karen in Madison is back, so let's go there. Karen, hello.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay, my topic is right on what you were just talking about. What is going on in Wisconsin and all over the United States is what is called tap accidents. They are accidents that are caused like a fender bender, what my father would have used when he was driving us around. And what the goal is to have the person's car hurt enough so that you can get a damage claim in and the insurance will pay for it. I had this happen in Madison down around the square. The driver stopped suddenly in front of me. He was in a van with a truck bumper on the back of it. I only tapped his bumper. There was no dent on either the bumper of mine or the bumper of his. But what did happen is the truck bumper was broken about 8 to 12 inches in, top to bottom, front to back. Not a crack. There was, I mean, you could see through it down to the ground. He said, I caused that. No way in heck could I have caused that damage with no damage to my front bumper.
Tap accidents.
Yeah, I don't have a lot of, unfortunately, I just have to say I don't have a lot of experience or knowledge. I'm sure it happens. I've not, I just don't have a lot of experience with that.
Yeah, can't comment on that, Karen. I appreciate your call. Lots of emails. Matt emailed to ask, what's the status of self-driving vehicles in Wisconsin, and can they operate in winter conditions?
That's another great big huge topic that we could run this show until about 5 p.m. today talking about self-driving and automated vehicles, right? Wisconsin has, we're the UW, what we call the UW TOPS lab in Madison, is part of a research program evaluating those. Bottom line is they're happening in other states. They're not in Wisconsin right now as far as self-driving, completely self-driving vehicles. Where we are with them, if you are able to buy one that has that capability yourself, as the you're still the driver of the vehicle, you're still responsible for anything that driver that vehicle does, meaning the technology may or may not work. You have to, you just can't get behind the wheel of a vehicle today and go to sleep and say, take me home. You're still responsible for whatever that vehicle does, even if it's in full automated mode. Interesting twist to that question was, can they drive in the wintertime? And I, again, it's outside my area of expertise. I'm sure that people will tell you, or the engineers will tell you, that they can or they will. But the bottom line is they still are relied, they rely a lot on infrastructure, meaning lines on the road and things like that, that the computer needs to be able to sense and see. So I'm sure winter driving here in Wisconsin is going to present some unique challenges for fully automated vehicles, but that's further down the road than we are right now.
Bill emailed, he's trying to convince his elderly father that driving too slow is just as dangerous as driving too fast. Bill's dad says, that's wrong. Who's right? Bill wants to know.
Well, both might be right. I guess it depends on the definition, which is a personal definition of too slow. Now, we have a unique issue with speed. And the bottom line is in Wisconsin, I'm sure other states are similar, but I spend a lot of time on speed. We're focused on it because if we lower the speed involved in any crash, we're going to increase the survivability. I'll repeat that. Lower the speed involved in any crash, whether it's a city street at 25 miles an hour or a highway at 55 miles an hour, you lower the speed involved in that crash, more people survive. Bottom line is, in Wisconsin, we know, we have the data to show that our speed limits are not our speed limits, they're the minimum speed. So a 55-mile-an-hour highway, most people consider that 55 or more. Nobody goes 52 or 51. So with that as the foundation, what is too slow? On the interstate, where the speed limit is 70, it's against the law to go below 45. Because of that speed differential, over 25 miles an hour in that example can be dangerous. But I would caution people to say that an older driver doing 50 or even 48, 47 miles an hour in a 55 zone, I wouldn't consider that too slow. I wouldn't consider that dangerous, because we all should be treating our speed limits as the maximum allowed speed on that road, not the minimum.
I was interviewed a traffic engineer who had worked in road construction and so forth. And he said that the way we've built roads is probably needs to be rethought, and streets as well. Because as an engineer, you always thought, well, we'll make the roads wider and bigger and faster. And the same with the streets, and it's basically probably just the opposite.
Boy, there's a lot of truth to that, Larry. And thankfully, Wisconsin's finally coming around a little bit. We were lagging a few other states in our country And as I mentioned earlier, referred to some of our international Scandinavian countries, for example. Yes, you're exactly right. We've been building streets wider and bigger and flatter for decades, and that drives speed up. And the higher the speed, the lower the survivability of any crash. So now you're starting to see a shift of narrowing streets, and we call it traffic calming and or road diets. Narrow the street a little bit, make people go slower, and more people will survive the crashes. And again, it takes a lot of time to shift a paradigm like that, but it's happening in communities just like Madison, Wisconsin, where they're designing some of the local side streets narrower and lowering the speed limit to 20 miles an hour from even 25 or 30, because it drastically increases crash survivability.
We just 2 days ago, they finished the street that I live on, and it is now much narrower and still involves the ability to park on one side of the street. And believe me, you're not going to go barreling through on our street because it's pretty narrow,
especially if there's cars, and that's intentional.
Yeah.
Yes.
Or even East Washington Avenue, where the rapid bus lane now takes up one of the three lanes, and now it's a two-lane road for traffic as opposed to three-lane.
Yeah, we went through a long period of time, and not just Wisconsin, but of designing our roads to minimize congestion, because whether we want to admit it or not, culturally, we're all in a hurry. We're in a hurry for whatever, it doesn't really matter what, but we're in a hurry, and we don't want to be slowed down by traffic. So we built bigger roads, more lanes, wider roads, and now we're kind of coming full circle where we realize that that seriously injures and kills more people. Whereas if we just would all slow down and reduce the amount of speed that's involved in these crashes, because we will always have crashes, people will make mistakes, we're never going to have perfect drivers, but the mistakes don't need to necessarily result in serious injury or death.
We have an email from Andrea. On her commute, there are several crosswalks with flashing lights to notify drivers of crossing pedestrians. She says sometimes people just activate the light and cross immediately, expecting to drivers to stop on a dime. What sort of responsibility or accountability do pedestrians have when crossing the street?
Well, yeah, that's an interesting issue in our urban areas. Those lights are super, super effective. They are pretty expensive to put in, but they're very effective because they alert drivers. But pedestrians have a responsibility they have a right to cross the road in a crosswalk and not be run over and killed. But they have a responsibility to make sure that the cars coming see the lights and see them. And we talked a while ago, Larry, about distracted driving. And there is a real issue with distracted walking. And so people, unfortunately, have their head down in their phone and they're walking and they see a crosswalk and they push the button and they just start walking across and they don't look up to make sure that the cars are going to yield. Even though the cars are required to yield, it's going to really hurt if the car doesn't yield and you step out in front of them. So it's a shared responsibility.
We are talking with Randy Wiesinger, retired Dane County Sheriff, detective, currently a law enforcement liaison and consultant for the Wisconsin DOT's Bureau of Transportation Safety. Questions, again, you could email to talk@wpr.org or give a call at 800-642-1234. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking today about driver education, driver safety, the rules of the road with our guest Randy Wiesinger, law enforcement liaison and consultant for the Wisconsin DOT's Bureau of Transportation Safety. Dick in Brooklyn has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Dick.
Hey, thank you, Larry, for taking my call. I lived in the Brooklyn area. I have a farm that I currently farm, though I'm in retirement. Local road commissioner, who's an attorney, stopped and told me that I needed to remove some weeds in the corner of a field at a four-way, a crossroads, one of which was controlled by a stop sign, because my weeds were impairing whether an oncoming driver who was at the stop sign, if he stopped there, he couldn't see if there was oncoming traffic from the other direction. Those weeds in my corn are well out of the legal roadway that I have there. I don't feel that's correct. He told me I had legal liability if an accident occurred. And I guess I want to know, is that true or is that incorrect? My feeling is the stop sign, if that's the case, the stop sign should be moved closer to the crossroads so that the driver can see it. But right now, even when I did remove the weeds, my corn still obstructed the vision of the driver behind the stop sign.
Yeah, that's it's kind of difficult for me to give you a definitive answer because it's unique to that situation there. But in general sense, I would say, every road has a right-of-way that the municipality is in charge of, and then outside of that road right-of-way is private property. I can't, describe your exact situation there, but in a general sense, I can tell you that we do work on sight lines so that people approaching that stop sign can see left and right. On one hand, I will tell you that having no sight lines until you get to the stop sign, you can't see left or right until you get to the stop sign, might cause people to actually stop versus roll through a stop sign. But at the same time, that's a specific instance where I'm not in a position to counteract whatever that commissioner told you, because I'm not familiar with the situation there.
Yeah, you'd have to almost see it to be able to make a comment on it, I would think.
As far as the liability, reality is we live in a lawsuit happy society, so you share some liability always, and anything you can do to reduce that is probably a good thing, but I'm not sure that you would be responsible.
Gene emailed, what's the rule of thumb for when you should be driving in the left lane on the freeway?
Well, we do have a statute on impeding traffic. I do take issue with sometimes the perception of that. Going back to my passionate plea about we need to slow people down and obey the speed limit. In Wisconsin, our speed limit is an absolute law, so it's not a guideline. It's not a minimum speed. It's a maximum speed. So 70 means 70 on the interstate. It doesn't mean 75 or 80, but we have a long ways to go there. So as long as you're doing the speed limit and you're in the left lane, technically you shouldn't be impeding traffic. But if you have traffic backed up, the ideal place to be is in the right lane when you're on a divided highway, or the furthest to the right lane and not in that left lane.
John wonders, how many points can you get or lose to get your driver's license, to get on your driver's license before it's revoked?
I don't think anything's changed. It's been a long time since I did anything with the merit points. 12 points in a rolling 12-month period will get you, more than that will suspend your license. Meaning a rolling 12-month period is after a year, and I think it's a little over a year, those points start to come back, and so you start earning your points back.
Mike in Madison has something. Let's go there. Hi, Mike.
Hi. Good morning. Just wanted to put a quick plug in for Ralph Nader, whose actions from the 1960s onward have probably saved tens of thousands of lives. That thought line. There's thousands of country roads that cross highways, and the stop signs could be wrapped with the newer LED lights and the solar panels. I'm curious to know if there's any activity or actions or moving forward to have some sort of progressive action to add that feature to rural stop signs. We had an incident north of Madison a year or two ago where three or four young kids coming home from a concert didn't see a stop sign, a country stop sign, because of heavy fog, and they got T-boned by a semi, and all of them perished, unfortunately.
Yeah, there is great technology to enhance the visibility of those stop signs. You know, in a general sense, I will tell you that unfortunately, we are pretty reactive, meaning we don't really, whether it's the local county or state DOT, tends not to address those until we have a trend of crashes. And that's unfortunate. I say that's unfortunate because sometimes we know where those issues are. We could proactively do something before we have that crash data, because crash data that drives decisions like that and funding decisions like that is important, but crash data is lives. Every number on our data sheet, if you will, is a life. So it's really up to those local communities, counties, and some do it more than others to proactively put those countermeasures in, but it comes at a cost. And so that's usually the driving factor, unfortunately.
Mike, thank you very much for calling. But lighting those stoplights would be it's probably an expensive proposition.
Yeah, I think that the cost is coming, is coming down. It's really one of those things where a community or a county or area needs to be proactive and decide that they want to do it before they have the crashes.
Brad in Minnesota emailed to say he thinks the minimum driving age for new drivers should be 18 or maybe even 21. Many European countries have a minimum age of 18 or 21. And their driver's education courses are somewhere close to a year. He is 54 now, got his license at 16, but looking back, thinks he had no business being behind the wheel at that age.
Well, I can't disagree with our Minnesota neighbor there, but how other countries approach driver education and teen driving does correlate with they kill less people on their roads. I don't think that Wisconsin's going to have an appetite for that. In my lifetime, we just lowered the age actually to 15 for you to get your temps from 15 and a half. So I think it really is incumbent on us as parents, and now I'm a grandparent, to properly train our drivers.
And Mark and Baraboo, what's on your mind?
Hi, yes. I just have a general question. Last year, I was driving home from work on Interstate 94 in a construction zone. So you're going from 70 miles an hour down to, I believe it was 60. And there was nobody working that I could see. But one of the barrels, it got down to two lanes. One of the barrels blew over and was directly in my lane. And I was driving roughly, 60-ish miles an hour. And this is probably three car lengths ahead of me. What should happen in that situation?
I mean, obviously do what you have to do to avoid that barrel striking that. But if the lane is obstructed like that, that certainly warrants a 911 call. Construction zones, the speed limits in construction zones are reduced for a variety of different reasons, not always just because workers are present, but because of conditions that are present create hazards. And so we want people to go slower and mitigate those hazards, right? So just because workers aren't present doesn't mean the reduced speed isn't applicable.
And on that note, Randy, we are out of time. I hope you can come back and be with us again. I didn't get through everything I wanted to ask you about, and there was plenty of people calling in, and probably more that we could discuss. Randy, thank you so much for being with us today. Appreciate it very much.
You're welcome. Thank you, Larry.
Randy Wiesinger, retired Dane County Sheriff Detective and liaison with the Wisconsin DOT's Bureau of Transportation Safety. Coming up, we got lots coming up here, including a visit with Brandy Grayson, founder and CEO of Urban Triage. That next. I'm Larry Mueller.